Hi, listeners, it's Vanessa. Before today's episode, I want to tell you about another show I think you'll love. Crime House and A&E are teaming up on the podcast version of the famous true crime series, The First 48. Each week, Carter Roy takes you inside a landmark homicide case, the interrogations, the dead ends, and the breakthroughs in the critical first 48 hours. Listen to and follow The First 48 every Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Crime House.
Most of us have dreamed about a life where money isn't a concern. Maybe you'd finally get that dream car or book an expensive vacation. Or maybe something much simpler, like paying a bill without having to check your bank account first. Usually these fantasies are harmless. But for a man named Kenneth Regan, his dreams weren't just a passing thought. They were an obsession. In the 1990s, Kenneth chased wealth the only way he knew how, through crime. And when the life of luxury he'd built for himself slipped from his grasp, Kenneth wasn't willing to accept the loss. In fact, he was determined to get it back, even if it meant heinously murdering an innocent family. The human mind is powerful. It shapes how we think, feel, love, and hate. But sometimes it drives people to commit the unthinkable. This is Serial Killers and Murderous Minds, a Crime House original. I'm Vanessa Richardson.
And I'm forensic psychologist Dr. Tristan Engels. Every Monday and Thursday, we uncover the darkest minds in history, analyzing what makes a killer.
Crime House is made possible by you. Please rate, review, and follow Serial Killers and Murderous Minds. To enhance your listening experience with ad-free early access to each two-part series and bonus content, subscribe to Crime House Plus on Apple Podcasts. Before we get started, be advised this episode contains discussion and depictions of violence. Please listen with care. Today, we begin our deep dive on Kenneth Regan, a money-hungry career criminal who'd do anything to rise to the top. Kenneth's greed was so powerful, he was willing to betray and manipulate everyone. And when there was just one man left in his way, Kenneth turned on him in the most shocking way possible.
As Vanessa goes through the story, I'll be talking about things like how some offenders become fixated on wealth at an early age, what drives career criminals to betray those closest to them, and why these offenders see violence as a means to an end.
And as always, we'll be asking the question, what makes a killer? Kenneth Regan only seemed to care about one thing in life, being filthy rich. He was born just outside London in 1953 into a lower-class family. Not much is known about his childhood, except that money was never a guarantee, and the Regans struggled to get by. As Kenneth entered adulthood, he didn't want to keep living under constant financial stress. However, he wasn't interested in merely making a living. Kenneth wanted it all. He was obsessed with all things luxury. Cars, clothes, bottle service, you name it. Kenneth's number one goal was to live the good life. At the same time, he hated the idea of going to work each day and climbing the corporate ladder. The life of an honest, hard-working man seemed boring to him. Kenneth wanted to make as much money as possible as quickly as possible. So in the 1970s, when he was in his 20s, Kenneth set his sights on the drug trade. Having grown up in a rougher part of the city, he already had the connections, so it was easy for him to get a foot in the door, especially because he didn't have a criminal record. The authorities didn't know who he was, so he'd draw less attention. Kenneth was quickly enlisted in low-level dirty work. It was gritty and high risk, and he appeared to love every minute of it.
Research shows that individuals who pursue these kinds of criminal paths often have a higher tolerance for risk, a stronger need for stimulation, or a tendency toward impulsive decision-making. For some, pro-social routes to financial success feel slow, inaccessible, or out of reach, especially for someone like Kenneth, who grew up in an environment where wealth was highly valued but difficult to obtain. There can also be powerful social influences. If someone is surrounded by peers or role models who are making quick money through illegal means, that lifestyle can start to feel normalized or even glorified. Over time, they may start to see crime as a practical or even strategic choice, which ultimately shapes their decision-making and their lifestyle. It's important, though, to remember that many people do grow up in poverty or face limited opportunities and they never turn to crime. So we're usually looking at a mixture of personality traits, environment, opportunity, and the individual's beliefs about what they're entitled to or capable of achieving that create these kinds of environments or create the motivation for this lifestyle.
Do you think fast money and status outweigh any fear of consequences? And if so, is that a sign that underneath it all, he's actually seeking validation and power?
I think it depends on how they perceive risk. Many people who engage in high-reward criminal activity, at least according to research, often discount future consequences. So in other words, the immediate payoff feels more real and more important than any punishment that seems distant or uncertain, or at least to them, avoidable. That's typically influenced by what I previously outlined, like impulsivity, sensation seeking, and environments that reward that behavior. But it's also influenced by prior successes. That can be highly reinforcing. And as for whether that reflects a need for validation or power, that's certainly possible. For some people, wealth and status become tied to their sense of identity or their self-worth. If they feel insignificant, powerless, or deprived in earlier life experiences, external things like money, luxury, or influence can take on exaggerated importance to them. That can be true for Kenneth, especially if he felt economically deprived in life. I mean, classism can affect someone's self-worth, their feelings of control and power, and their identity.
Kenneth's dedication was obvious to his superiors. Before long, he was reportedly rubbing elbows with much more experienced criminals, including members of the Clerkenwell Crime Syndicate, one of Britain's most powerful drug smuggling networks. They allegedly taught him how to move bigger shipments and build wealth beyond his wildest dreams. Kenneth knew he'd found his place in life. Eventually, he rose through the ranks of organized crime, which gave him the freedom to run his own operations. But he never did it alone. By the early 1990s, when Kenneth was approaching his 40s, he'd aligned himself with an experienced underworld figure named William Hornsey. William helped Kenneth take his enterprise to the next level, and he would become one of Kenneth's closest allies. Together, they embarked on all kinds of criminal activity, which reportedly included drug smuggling, money laundering, and sophisticated passport fraud schemes that allowed other criminals to go off the grid and operate under false identities. Kenneth and William had something else in common. They both loved money. But even as cash practically rained down on them, it never seemed to be enough. Kenneth was always looking for his next big opportunity. And in 1992, that ambition led him to cross paths with Michael Shalamach, a businessman from the UK who made a living setting up ventures in Nigeria. After they met, Michael and Kenneth entered a lucrative business deal together. The details of their agreement aren't clear. What we do know is that Michael had no idea how shady Kenneth really was. Because that April, after the two met to discuss the deal, Michael vanished without a trace. Unlike Kenneth, Michael's top priority in life was his family. So from the moment he went missing, his loved ones were adamant that something happened to him. They told police he wasn't the type of person to simply disappear. Michael's wife also explained that they were supposed to go on vacation together in just a few days. Plus, all of his clothes and personal belongings had been left behind, so the police started investigating. And within days, strange clues began to surface. First, Michael's car was found abandoned in Paris. A few weeks after that, his wife received a strange letter in the mail. It appeared to be from a woman named Helen, who claimed she and Michael had run off to start a new life together. However, investigators could tell the letter was fake. They weren't convinced Michael would abandon his family. The letter made them realize there was someone out there intent on concealing the truth. In their search for answers, investigators questioned Michael's friends and associates, including Kenneth Regan. They used people's statements to piece together a timeline of the days leading up to his disappearance, and they realized Kenneth was the last person to see him alive. They dug deeper into Kenneth's potential involvement, but found no physical evidence of a crime, which meant they couldn't seriously consider Kenneth as a suspect.
At this point in the story, we don't know what happened to Michael or whether or not Kenneth was involved. But that being said, when a person engages in risky or harmful behavior and doesn't experience meaningful consequences, that absence of punishment can actually strengthen the behavior over time. So if someone believes that they may have gotten away with a serious offense like this, it can shape how they see the world. They may start to view the legal system as ineffective, or they may begin to believe they're smarter than the people that are trying to catch them. And that can create a psychological feedback loop that the more they succeed without consequences, the more confident or overconfident they become in taking even bigger risks. That can also reinforce a sense of invincibility or entitlement. They may begin to feel that rules are for other people, not for them. As if rules are obstacles, but of course, not everyone who avoids consequences develops this type of mindset. In most cases, people become more anxious or cautious, but this is a very specific case and a very specific set of circumstances. And from a behavioral standpoint, repeated success without consequence is one of the strongest ways risky or criminal behavior becomes more entrenched, especially in someone like Kenneth.
If Kenneth was involved in Michael's disappearance, it doesn't seem like he ever admitted it to anyone. Instead, he and William Hornsey went back to living large. As the 1990s rolled on, Kenneth continued to bankroll his lifestyle through his life of crime and even earned the nickname Captain Cash. And with that kind of reputation, he wasn't exactly lying low. Kenneth openly flaunted his wealth. He bought expensive cars, luxury clothes, and partied at London clubs and bars where liquor flowed endlessly, all on his dime. And in 1997, Kenneth was partying at a bar when he met a woman who changed his life forever. Her name was Belinda Bruin. She was a charming socialite who was close friends with the famous TV host Paula Yates. Belinda was a social icon in 90s London, and naturally, Kenneth wanted to get as close to her as possible. They struck up a friendship, but Kenneth seemed to want more. He offered to take Belinda on luxury vacations and buy her designer jewelry, but she always said no. Kenneth was okay with that. He still wanted to be friends, mainly because Belinda ran with the elite. If he could impress her and get in with her crowd, then those connections might be useful to him one day. Kenneth was always thinking a few steps ahead, but before he could plan his next move, the law finally caught up with him. On June 17, 1998, 45-year-old Kenneth was arrested after being caught transporting 30 kilograms of heroin. He was charged with drug trafficking and passport racketeering. Together, they carried a potential sentence of 20 years in prison. Spending time behind bars was never part of Kenneth's plan. A long prison sentence meant losing access to his money and his lifestyle. So in true Kenneth fashion, he went looking for the fastest solution. He agreed to cooperate with police and struck up a deal to testify against his associates, including the person closest to him, William Hornsey. In exchange, Kenneth received a reduced sentence of 8 years in prison.
Turning on William tells us about Kenneth's priorities and himself. He's in self-preservation mode. His primary concern appears to be minimizing his own consequences, even if that meant betraying someone he was close to. That kind of decision-making is consistent with a view of relationships where people are valued for what they provide rather than for loyalty or emotional connection. Research on organized crime and high-level offenders does show that alliances are often built around profit, protection, or opportunity. And when those incentives disappear or when the personal cost becomes too high, there are no more perceived benefits to those relationships. He's also not thinking long-term because he doesn't seem to have considered how this would affect his reputation, his perception of trust, or the moral code within his criminal environment. That could put him at a different risk than the one he's presently trying to avoid.
Kenneth may have gotten off easy with the law, but that deal came at a cost. Word spread quickly through the world of organized crime that Kenneth Regan was a snitch. He knew that label was permanent, which meant he'd have to rebuild his empire on his own from the ground up, and he didn't waste a single minute. Kenneth viewed his time behind bars as an opportunity, not to change his ways, but to maintain them. He started learning everything he could about his fellow inmates and formed connections with those he viewed most beneficial. Soon, Kenneth met a man he knew would be key to gaining everything he ever wanted in life, and he started planning his most nefarious scheme yet. By 1998, 45-year-old Kenneth Regan was behind bars, serving time for drug trafficking and passport racketeering. But even though he was in prison, Kenneth probably wasn't thinking about rehabilitation. He was planning his next move. Now that he'd betrayed all his old associates, Kenneth had to rebuild his network. Starting with a fellow inmate named Amarjeet Chauhan, who went by the name Anil. Anil was a businessman in his late 30s. He'd been in prison for almost 2 years by the time Kenneth got there, after being convicted of tax evasion. But unlike Kenneth, he intended to lead an honest life after his release. He wanted to put his past behind him and enjoy life with his wife and two young sons. And he was looking forward to a second chance at growing his business. Anil's company was called Seba Freight Services. It was a shipping and logistics company that operated out of the Heathrow area, and it was worth millions. When Kenneth learned about this, he saw dollar signs. Not only was there a ton of money in the company, but a large-scale shipping operation was every drug smuggler's dream. If Kenneth could get in at Seba, he'd have warehouses, established routes, and transportation at his disposal. Not only that, but he could launder his drug money, too. Step one was becoming friends with Anil, which Kenneth made sure to do. He presented himself as someone who also wanted to shed his past and embark on the straight and narrow. And Anil believed him.
So at this point, Kenneth has burned his bridges with his previous criminal network, which means he needs to build a new one. And from what we've seen in his history, his relationships do appear to be based on utility. We also see a pattern of decisions that prioritize fast money, excitement, and short-term reward. So when he meets someone like Anil, it was likely more about opportunity. Here's a person who isn't deeply embedded in organized crime, who seems focused on rebuilding his life, and who happens to own a very valuable company that Kenneth sees potential in. From a purely strategic standpoint, that would have been very appealing to Kenneth. But in order to access that opportunity, he would have needed Anil's trust. And that's where impression management comes in. People who spend years in high-level criminal environments often become very skilled at presenting themselves in ways that make others feel comfortable, understood, or aligned. They can be chameleons. They adjust themselves to the person, their needs, and what works for each person and the moment. That doesn't always necessarily require deception. Sometimes it's as simple as mirroring the other person's goals. When someone sees alignment, it can naturally build trust. So what we may be seeing here is Kenneth is identifying opportunity. He's building a relationship around that opportunity because he burned all his other relationships. And he's using social skill or impression management to gain access to what he wants that Anil has.
Do you think it's possible that Kenneth convinced himself that his actions were justified?
Oh, yeah, I think it's certainly possible. I mean, based on the behavioral patterns that you've described, like repeated rule breaking, prioritizing personal gain, his disregard for how others are affected, one psychological concept that may help explain this is just moral disengagement. And that's when a person gradually shifts the way that they think about their actions, so their actions no longer feel wrong to them. Instead of seeing their behavior as harmful, they reframe it as justified or necessary or even deserved. And over time, that thinking can make increasingly serious behavior feel acceptable in their own mind. In my work with offenders, it's not uncommon to see people justify their actions in this way. It often serves a psychological function too. If someone is engaging in behavior that conflicts with basic moral standards, they have to create some kind of mental distance from the harm they're causing. Otherwise, it becomes much harder to continue the behavior or exist in a lifestyle that they don't feel that they can leave. And this is something I found very common among individuals who are, you know, affiliated with gangs, and this is very similar to organized crime.
Kenneth would do whatever was necessary to get what he wanted. Over the next few years, he maintained his facade. It's unclear whether Anil knew what had landed Kenneth in prison or the true extent of his criminal endeavors, but Kenneth pretended to be Anil's friend, and in the summer of 2002, he began reaping the benefits. By that point, Kenneth had been released from prison early, though it's unclear why. However, what should have felt like a win ended up being a tough blow for Kenneth. He had to move back in with his father in a working-class London suburb and drive a used car. It was a far cry from the life he once knew, and he found it humiliating. He was desperate to get his old life back as quickly as possible, so he reached out to Anil, who was also out of prison. He was back in charge of his company and had been leading a quiet, stable life with his wife and kids. In fact, after having time to reflect on things, Anil was now thinking of selling Seba Freight so he could retire early and move to India to be closer to family. But for now, he kept the wheels of his business in motion. And when Kenneth reached out, Anil happily agreed to meet with him. Shortly after that meeting ended, Kenneth was employed at Seba Freight as a long-haul truck driver. To Anil, Kenneth was a man willing to do whatever it took to rehabilitate himself. But in reality, Kenneth just wanted to get a foot in the door. And just days after starting his new job, he learned that Anil was interested in selling Seba Freight. So Kenneth approached him with an idea. Kenneth told Anil that he knew wealthy investors who were interested in buying the company. He said they'd purchase it outright for £3 million, just over $5 million at the time and almost $10 million today. Anil was stunned. It was an incredible offer, almost too good to be true. He had no idea that it was, in fact, a total lie. Kenneth didn't know any investors. He was simply trying to scam Anil out of ownership of the company. Anil told Kenneth he'd consider it, but he hadn't agreed to anything before Kenneth started putting his plan into motion. He knew that to persuade Anil, he'd have to make all the business dealings look convincing, so he turned to the one person who could make that happen, his old acquaintance, William Hornsey. Kenneth wanted William's help forging documents, and even though he'd betrayed William in the past, William agreed to help in exchange for a cut of the earnings.
What we see here is a continuation of a pattern that we've been discussing, which is how Kenneth appears to approach relationships in a very instrumental way. He values people largely for what they can provide and nothing more. So reaching back out to someone he previously betrayed might seem alarming, risky, or even bold to all of us, but it may not feel contradictory to him because that person is still useful despite the bad blood. That kind of behavior can be associated with traits like entitlement or grandiose thinking. That suggests he feels justified in pursuing what he wants, regardless of the impact on others. He also may believe he is smarter, more capable, or deserving of success, even if it comes through deception. There's also a strong goal-focused or outcome-driven style of thinking here, because instead of being concerned about the ethics or the fallout, he's concerned about the outcome. When someone consistently is prioritizing the end result over the means, that can lead to increasingly risky or manipulative behavior. So psychologically, what this suggests is a person who's highly opportunistic, is comfortable repairing and reusing relationships when it benefits them despite the risks, and primarily is motivated by personal gain.
What does it say about someone's mindset when they so confidently promise money they don't actually have?
In addition to the overconfidence and grandiose thinking we talked about earlier, it's also important to look at how long this focus on money appears to have been part of his identity. It's been there since he was a child. And when someone becomes so fixated on wealth or status from such a young age, that goal can start to fuse with their sense of self over time. So money isn't just a resource anymore. It becomes a symbol of who they are, or who they believe they're supposed to be, and how they want to be perceived. So in that context, presenting himself as someone who has access to wealth or who knows powerful investors may have served more than just a practical purpose or a deception. It's meant to reinforce the identity that he's the successful, well-connected, high-status individual. Promising money he doesn't actually have may also reflect a need to preserve a self-concept and the lifestyle that he tied to it.
If Kenneth was driven by a need for power, it wasn't going to be that easy, because even though Anil said he'd consider the offer, he wasn't in a rush to sell his company. Plus, there were other interested buyers. Anil intended to put careful thought into the matter, which meant Kenneth had to wait. But he didn't want to do that. And if he couldn't get his way immediately, he figured he could at least act the part. Even though he was a brand new employee, Kenneth started inserting himself deeper into Anil's world. Over the next few months, he introduced himself to Anil's business contacts. And while some of them knew he was a truck driver, Kenneth claimed to be a partner in the company. A few people believed him, and soon he was even taking high-level meetings. Then, as a cherry on top, Kenneth started bringing around his old friend, the wealthy socialite Belinda Bruin. He wanted to use her to convince people he was respected and well-connected. Unfortunately, touting Belinda had the opposite effect. Some of Anil's associates found it strange that a low-level truck driver would be so ingrained in London's high society. On top of that, they soon realized he didn't actually have any power in the company, so they started distancing themselves from him. Once that happened, Kenneth realized that if he wanted to impress people, he'd need more to his name. Living with his dad certainly didn't help cultivate an image of a savvy, successful businessman. Kenneth had to buy his dad's house. To do that, he applied for a mortgage and lied on his application, claiming to have worked at SEBA much longer than he actually had. It's unclear whether Anil found out about this, but he did know about all of Kenneth's other lies and posturing. He'd heard about everything from his friends and associates. He realized Kenneth couldn't be trusted. It became clear to Anil that his newest employee had a much bigger agenda than he was letting on. Anil didn't want to get tangled up in something that could compromise his future with his family. So by February 2003, after Kenneth had been working at SEBA for just a few months, Anil told him there was no deal.
Social rejection affects everyone. Research shows that it activates some of the same brain regions associated with physical pain. It can trigger emotions like shame, anger, humiliation, or fear about the future. How someone responds to that rejection depends a lot on how they define themselves. So if his identity is strongly tied to success, status, or wealth, then losing a major opportunity can feel like a threat. For individuals, especially those who are very outcome-driven or entitled in their thinking, rejection can also feel unjust or intolerable. So rather than seeing it as a normal part of life, they may interpret it as a personal betrayal or an obstacle. That can lead to anger or desperation, particularly if they feel cornered or humiliated. Of course, many people experience rejection and respond in healthy, adaptive ways, but in individuals who already show patterns of impulsivity, entitlement, or high-risk decision-making, rejection can sometimes become a catalyst for more extreme or reckless behavior.
Well, Kenneth wasn't willing to take no for an answer. And Anil's rejection prompted him to make a decision of his own. If Anil wouldn't give him the company, then he'd take it himself, no matter what the cost. By February 2003, 50-year-old Kenneth Regan was running out of patience. His plan to take over SEBA Freight Services had stalled after the company's owner and Kenneth's former prison mate, Anil Chauhan, declined to sell the company. Kenneth had lied to Anil, saying he knew investors who were willing to pay top dollar, but Anil's gut told him not to trust his newly hired truck driver, so he politely refused the offer. The rejection seemed to cause issues between the two men. Even though Kenneth continued working for SEBA, people close to Anil noticed a sudden shift in his demeanor. Normally, Anil had an easygoing attitude, but seemingly out of nowhere, he seemed stressed and overwhelmed.
Obviously, I haven't met Anil, so we can't know exactly what he was thinking or feeling in this moment. But looking at the context, one possible explanation is that his threat response had become more activated. When people begin to suspect dishonesty, ulterior motives, or potential risk in their environment, the brain can shift into a more vigilant state. It's a protective mechanism. They can start scanning for problems or second-guessing decisions, even worrying about things that could possibly go wrong. And from the outside, that can look like a sudden change in mood or personality. If Anil had reason to question Kenneth's honesty or intentions, and in all honesty, he did, that kind of uncertainty could naturally increase stress. We tend to feel most comfortable when situations are predictable and under our control. And when trust begins to deteriorate or the future starts to feel uncertain, anxiety does begin to increase. What we may be seeing here is anticipatory anxiety. That's when a person is stressed, not because something bad has already happened, but because they're worried about what might happen. The anticipation of a threat can sometimes be just as distressing as the threat itself. So the shift in his demeanor may reflect that internal stress response, which is an increased sense of uncertainty, reduced trust, and a growing fear that the situation could lead to something more serious.
It wasn't just Anil's mood that shifted. Some of his closest associates knew he'd been considering selling Seba Freight so he could retire and move back to his wife's homeland of India with their two young sons, one of whom was a newborn. But now, Anil seemed unsure about the future of his company. People couldn't help but notice that the sudden shift in Anil's behavior seemed to coincide with Kenneth's growing obsession with the business. However, it's unclear if anyone knew Anil had rejected Kenneth's buyout proposal. Kenneth, for his part, was acting like that conversation with Anil had never happened. Behind the scenes, he'd already started preparing his takeover. He didn't tell any other members of the company what he was up to, and if he did, they would have been shocked. Kenneth knew he could never be the face of Seba Freight. After all, he'd only been working there a short time in a low-level position. Not to mention, he was known to police as a drug smuggler. To employees, banks, and anyone on the outside, it wouldn't make sense for him to suddenly be running a multi-million dollar business. So Kenneth reached out to his old friend, Belinda Bruin, for help. Belinda had a spotless record, so she wouldn't raise any red flags. The only issue was that she'd moved out to the countryside a couple of years earlier. She wanted to live a quieter life after her good friend, the TV presenter Paula Yates, died of an accidental drug overdose. Then one day, Kenneth contacted her and said he had an offer she couldn't refuse. Kenneth told Belinda he was hiring a new managing director for Seba Freight Services. He told her that he and some associates were in the process of buying the company and needed someone to take over for the current owner, Anil Chauhan. Of course, Belinda didn't know what Kenneth was really up to, but she knew about his past, and she wasn't sure she wanted to go into business with him. Plus, she liked her new life. So Kenneth sweetened the deal. He told Belinda she only had to work 2 days a week and that he'd pay her a yearly salary of £72,000. That would have been just over $100,000 back then and about $200,000 today. Belinda's ears perked up. Even though she was apprehensive, she still had her livelihood to think about. She had a mortgage to pay now, plus she was a single mother with her kids' private school tuition to pay. So earning that much money and having such a flexible schedule was extremely appealing. In the end, Belinda accepted the position.
This is a continuation of a pattern. Kenneth doesn't appear to respect other people's boundaries when those boundaries interfere with his end goal. So it's not especially surprising that he would go behind Anil's back or that he would recruit someone like Belinda. To him, she was a social icon. From his perspective, more than likely, she represented status, credibility, and access. So his interest in her earlier seemed largely tied to her connections. She was associated with high-profile figures and carried a certain level of respectability. So it's highly likely that bringing her into this was strategic. In his mind, more than likely, her involvement could make the operation appear more legitimate and therefore make it successful to him. He's once again using people based on what they can provide for his own goal and his own needs.
Kenneth needed Belinda to make his forced takeover look clean, and getting her on board was just one of the first steps in his plan. He still had a few more things to prepare, and he had to do it quietly. First, Kenneth told Belinda she wouldn't officially step into the role until after the sale of the company was complete, which he said would happen sometime in the next few weeks. In the meantime, he wanted to do something for her to show his gratitude, a way to say thanks for coming on board. So one day, while Belinda was out, Kenneth enlisted the help of William Hornsey, as well as one of their other associates, Peter Reese. He sent them to Belinda's country property with heavy digging equipment. Kenneth knew that Belinda's property had irrigation issues. There was often a lot of mud buildup on the fields around her house. She'd been complaining about it, but never got around to fixing it. So Kenneth told William and Peter to dig a trench. However, Kenneth never did anything without a hidden agenda. He wasn't actually trying to help Belinda. He wanted to dig holes on her property so that he could bury evidence there later on. Belinda didn't know what his true intentions were, but when she got home that day to see what was happening, she was furious nonetheless. She marched over to William and demanded to know what was going on. He told her that Kenneth had sent them to fix the irrigation issue. But to Belinda, the story didn't add up. First of all, the trench was only about 12 feet long, which was useless on her 50-acre plot of land. It was more like a large hole than an actual trench. Plus, Belinda didn't see any pipes to be installed, which would have been important for irrigation. Then she noticed something else at the far end of the hole. It was a pile of charred debris. She tried to get a closer look at what it was, but William stopped her and said it was a sofa they'd brought with them to dispose of. Now, Belinda was certain they weren't doing this out of pure generosity. She told William to stop digging and fill the hole back in immediately. But he brushed her off and told her he'd get around to it over the summer, which was months away.
In social and legal contexts, consent is a basic expectation. People have the right to make decisions about their own property, their finances, and their lives. So when someone bypasses that process and later frames it as a gift or a favor, the person may believe that their intentions, however they frame it, are more important than the other person's right to choose. But the reality is, the impact matters more than the intention. When someone consistently prioritizes their own goals over other people's consent or well-being, it can point to a more control-oriented or entitlement-based mindset. The rules that normally, govern relationships like transparency, permission, and mutuality may begin to feel optional if they stand in the way of the desired outcome. This is a very clear boundary violation, and in most cases, it can put the receiver's nervous system on overdrive.
Do you think framing an intrusive act as a favor is a kind of a way to neutralize the guilt, or is it maybe meant to confuse the person on the receiving end?
It's not uncommon for people who engage in intrusive, controlling, or boundary-violating behavior to frame their actions as helpful or an act of kindness. This is because it serves a psychological purpose. On one level, it can reduce their own guilt. People often use mental justifications to make their behavior feel acceptable to themselves. If they can convince themselves that what they're doing is a favor, or that it's a kindness, or that it's going to benefit the other person in the long run, it becomes easier to cross those boundaries without feeling like they're doing something wrong, or without the other person believing that it's wrong, especially if it's intended to be manipulative. On another level, that framing can also influence the person on the receiving end. When an intrusive act is presented as generosity or concern, it can create confusion. The other person may start to question their own reaction. They're wondering if they're being ungrateful or overreacting, rather than recognizing that their boundaries were crossed. So it can help the person justify their behavior internally, but it can also make it harder for the people on the receiving end to push back or to recognize the behavior as inappropriate. And for someone like Kenneth, it's likely the latter.
Kenneth didn't have time to worry about Belinda's concerns because he still needed to handle the one major problem standing in his way from controlling the company, Anil. On February 13, 2003, Kenneth invited Anil to discuss the sale of Seba Freight once more in person.
they agreed to meet at Stonehenge that morning so they could take a stroll and chat. And just like those giant stones, what happened next has remained a mystery.
While it seems like the two men did go to Stonehenge, Kenneth somehow convinced Anil to come back to his dad's house with him. But when they got there, Anil was in for a rude awakening because William and Peter were there waiting. As soon as Anil stepped through the door, they ambushed him. He was gagged and bound, drugged, and then forced to sign a forged power of attorney and other paperwork that gave Kenneth Regan full control of Seba Freight. Once Kenneth had that, Anil was of no use to him anymore, and he was never seen alive again. But the real horror was only just beginning.
Thanks so much for listening. Come back next time for the conclusion of our deep dive on Kenneth Regan.
Serial Killers and Murderous Minds is a Crime House original powered by Pave Studios. Here at Crime House, we want to thank each and every one of you for your support. If you like what you heard today, reach out on Instagram at Crime House. And don't forget to rate, review, and follow Serial Killers and Murderous Minds wherever you get your podcasts. Your feedback truly makes a difference.
And to enhance your listening experience, subscribe to Crime House Plus on Apple Podcasts. You'll get every episode of Serial Killers and Murderous Minds ad-free, along with early access to each thrilling two-part series and exciting Crime House bonus content. Serial Killers and Murderous Minds is hosted by me, Vanessa Richardson, and forensic psychologist Dr. Tristan Engels, and is a Crime House original powered by Pave Studios. This episode was brought to life by the Serial Killers and Murderous Minds team, Max Cutler, Ron Shapiro, Alex Benedon, Lori Marinelli, Natalie Pertzowski, Sarah Camp, Sarah Batchelor, Marky Lee, Sarah Tardiff, and Carrie Murphy. Thank you for listening.
Hi, listeners, it's Vanessa. Before today's episode, I want to tell you about another show I think you'll love. Crime House and A&E are teaming up on the podcast version of the famous true crime series, The First 48. Each week, Carter Roy takes you inside a landmark homicide case, the interrogations, the dead ends, and the breakthroughs in the critical first 48 hours. Listen to and follow The First 48 every Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to podcasts.